Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 115, where we will examine two articles by Robert K. Merton related to the sociology of science. The first is The Machine, the Worker, and the Engineer, published in the journal Science in 1947. And the second is Selected Problems of Fieldwork in the Planned Community, published in the journal American Sociological Review, also in 1947. To learn more about these and other works of Merton, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, this is Sarah from London.
Hello, this is Miranda from Leamington Spa in the UK.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. Welcome, everyone. And today we're going to be discussing the work of Robert K. Merton. Some of our episodes have been focused on a specific classic of organization theory. This particular episode, we're going to concentrate more on the person, perhaps a little bit, and choose just a couple of early works from Robert K. Merton's early repertoire. We'll get into the works in just a moment. But we wanted to do Merton because he represents a whole root of sociology. I know we'd like to talk about branches, so I guess we'll just take the plant metaphor to its logical conclusion. But he represents a whole subfield within sociology, and a lot of his early work was on the methods and approaches to doing research. Now, of course, his famous works came later. I'm going to hand it over to Sarah in a moment for that. But his most famous works came much later than the ones we're going to read. But I think that given, say, what's going on in academia right now with discussions about research methods and various other things, which we might get into later, it's kind of important to take a look at some of the early ideas about conducting field research. And so we're going to go ahead and do that with someone whose works really greatly predate some of the classic works that we've covered. They even go back and reference him. So Sarah, if you would introduce us to Robert K. Merton, and we'll go from there.
Absolutely. So core works that contribute to the sociology of work canon and the foundations of work theory that you might be familiar with, or the titles may have been on your doctoral references list, were really focused on what is the social function of science. That's a title of his article in American Journal of Sociology in 1941. Lots about structural sociology, what's now called structural sociology, so social role, social theory. And from the post-World War II period, where this begins, it's talking about patterns of influence, patterns of communication, really the foundations to what we've talked about on this podcast as networks materials before. And then if we go to the other side of the work we're about to talk today, is some of the papers that our listeners might definitely be familiar with, the most famous contribution of which is the Matthew effect in science. So a theory of cumulative advantage, or an examination of the rich get richer phenomenon. That cluster of investigations is very important in my work. We created a special section of the Journal of Management Inquiry on that, talking about some of the challenges to a rich get richer phenomenon, or the dark sides of a Matthew effect and other related effects in interpersonal influence. And that itself then led to a branch of what's now called meta-science, or research on research, which is studying knowledge creation, studying scientists as a profession, studying the researcher and the role of researcher in society. And that has had the longest arc directly from Merton's works to what we study today and to what audiences of this podcast might apply to their own works. And there are some other pockets of really amazingly impactful research, such as there's an entire library of his on serendipity, serendipity in science, but serendipity in social life as well. And as Tom mentioned, in the time and space that he was working, comments for doctoral students and future researchers on rigor and appropriateness of social research methods. So that's another one of the types of papers that we've chosen. So I think the two papers we'll discuss today are positioned at the beginning of the modern history of what is now the sociology of occupations and work, and also then as a methods commentary in the early days of the sociology journals, which of course feature variety of methods, but super, super emphasis on rigor. And so the two papers that we've chosen to talk about today, which are way back in the canon, as Tom said, they are at least 20 years before the Matthew Effect in Science was published. So one is actually a transcription of a lecture, and it's called The Machine, the Worker, and the Engineer. And this was a transcription of a lecture for the Conference on Engineering and Human Affairs at Princeton in 1946. And so it's a reaction to some of the existing work and the really the challenge that the workers were facing in the post-World War II industrial ramp-up, which I know Tom knows a lot more about. And the second paper we're going to be engaging with everyone today is called Selected Problems of Fieldwork in the Planned Community. This is a comment. It's almost like a very expanded methods section and then a post-publication reflection, although it's published as its own article in American Sociological Review about doing work with a planned community being a housing development, intentional urban housing development. So again, urban studies and really the birth of that in sociology.
Thank you, Sarah, for this. Where would we like to start? I found in particular quite interesting The Machine, the Worker, and the Engineer. So I'm thinking that that could be a good starting point to examine and then to bring in the second piece of work. What to say about The Machine, the Worker, and the Engineer? First of all, the title is quite catchy. Like, I think there is something about these pieces which are transcribed lectures, which gives you an idea of how university lectures were once upon a time, how I would like them to still be, but perhaps they are not anymore. And having sort of the expert in the room put forward perhaps controversial or novel opinions to a large room, it's really something that, you know, evokes me to films and sort of, you know, grand settings. So that's something in terms of like the setup. We're talking about a work, I think it's 47 or 46. 46. That's the delivered at Princeton. Yeah. So yes, lectures are quite different today, but that's another story for perhaps another episode. What I liked about this was how in a condensed, succinct manner, it touches upon some core concepts, each of which deserves possibly another chapter. So it's really examining what is happening in terms of changes in technology and how these impact the worker and society, but on multiple levels. So for instance, there is mention of the social relationships, how the social community within a workplace can actually change because the technology has changed. We're also talking about one's identity, one's perception of their recognition of their value, and how that can be affected by changes in technology. The other part that I found interesting was looking at skills and how, because of a technology, you were considered skilled, but perhaps not anymore. And obviously, you know, we think about this today and it is still extremely relevant. I mean, obviously, the first technology that comes to mind is generative AI and all those implications. But whatever is the technology that comes in play, all of these are elements and levels that can still be part of the debate and the conversation. That was something that I found particularly interesting. And then also the recognition of the importance of thinking about these things in a wider picture and the role of the engineer and the design elements and how this is important for every worker in the workplace.
Okay, yeah. And thank you for that. I I highlighted the first sentence of the second paragraph because it really gets to the art of why he's delivering this lecture. So widespread and deep-rooted is the belief that technological advance is a self-evident good, that men have largely failed to look into the conditions of society under which this is indeed the case. Self-evident good. Yeah, and when we last month, we did the revisit to the Tristan Bamforth episode, in which there was a very, very similar idea. And Tristan Bamforth was 5 years after this. But it was, but the study itself was done roughly at the same time, drawing a very similar conclusion. So you have this theme kind of reinforced, where going into this period, it's like, add a new technology, it'll make things more effective, more good, more efficient, and everything will be just peachy. And then suddenly nothing that happens. So when he talks about the machine, the worker, and the engineer, I took it to mean that these are like three, not so much abstractions, but three classes of roles, of which differently the impact of technology has to be studied. Kind of like socio-technical systems, but maybe there's some differences. I'm not sure that we can perhaps try to contrast the two later. But the idea being that there's an impact of technology on the worker. There's the impact of the technology itself. There's the sense of what the technology is and what it's supposed to accomplish, different from the worker. Although the title doesn't say manager, there's a lot of managerial aspects to this as well, like because the worker and the relationship to the supervisor changes, that much we know. And then the engineer, the one who's designing it, and he makes some pretty pointed comments about, like, the engineers of the time kind of felt distant from the work environment, such that whatever they designed, they didn't care. It was somebody else's problem what the actual implications were. He was looking at the engineer as, you know, the happy person in their own little cubicle, flailing away at new and interesting stuff without concern for the implications. But the point being that science at this point, the social science at this point, had not considered the relationship between the engineer, the machine, and the work environment. And so he works through those three roles and talks about, hey, we should be looking at things a little bit differently because technology advancements affect these two roles differently.
Can I also add one small thing about the beginning of the piece? I think it's quite impactful on how already Merton puts forward some of his deeper rooted values. So there is this idea, first of all, of already acknowledging ignorance is a first step towards creating knowledge. And I think that's a very strong piece of evidence around, you know, how he considers the role of the researcher and just science in general. But also something that really fascinated me more was this idea of the value of technology, which Tom has mentioned, but the value is dependent on who has access. So there is already a political dimension in play. Of course, the technology is a benefit, but you need to look at how many people can access it. So this kind of already brings in elements of cost and political power struggles. And I think this is already quite telling and quite interesting about the writer and the academic that we have at the center of our episode.
And also the large umbrella of his contributions are about status, interpersonal status, social status, hierarchies that eventually lead to network studies, as we've discussed in one of our previous episodes. But the perspective on status here is exactly what Miranda said. So he says, if technology is good, it is so because of its human implications, because large numbers of diversely placed men have occasion to regard it as such in light of their experience. I think that's incredibly forward for the time to say that you need to have buy-in from a large and varied group of stakeholders for this technology to ultimately be deemed worthy of future deployment and then development and investment. And this is really timely for me at the moment. I'm reading Daniel Susskind's book on growth and the historical treatment in economics of growth, to what volume, to what end, and for what purpose. And he has a section on how the changes in farming technologies were not universally welcomed. And the reaction to that was the same as we would say to the massive room-filling computer, or to then the personal computer, or to, as Miranda said, whichever is your next technology in light. One of the discussions that the paper brings up is about the anxiety of job insecurity of the worker and bringing the worker in. And he talks about the importance of his audience, which in this case is another room full of academics, as is our audience today, taking up this mantle for research to investigate the effects of improved or increased technology on the individual worker. It says, limited as they are, the data on technological unemployment, displacement of labor, obsolescence of skills, discontinuities in employment, and decreases in jobs per unit of product all indicate that workers bear the brunt of failures to plan the orderly introduction of advances in the processes of production. I think that's a pretty clear statement and potentially a provocation for the managers that Tom mentioned, who are not in the title but who are central to the article and what we're talking about. But I think it's great that it puts very specific, measurable items in a list of what to be careful for and what is causing these job insecurities and the anxieties. Because as a researcher, you look at that and say, wonderful, there's a list of input and output variables that I can design into my next study.
Right. And the whole article is a laundry list of research topics. And one thing I love about this particular article is that, yes, just about everything has a contemporary analog, almost word for word, which we can get into. But let's stick with what's written here for the time, because I think that's itself is worth exploring. I'm just going to start with one of his early subsections under the first major section, social consequences of changes in technology, just to sort of illustrate what we're talking about here. So he has a subsection, social anatomy of the job. I'll just, hit some of the highlights. It has become plain that new productive processes and equipment inevitably affect the network of social relations among workers engaged in production. That same finding was reinforced by Tristan Bamforth, again from last month's episode. But then he offers in italicized phrases all of the particulars behind that, such as management may nourish the job insecurities and anxieties of workers through the enforced obsolescence of skills. Labor-saving technology produces acute psychological and social problems for the worker. So you think about what the Longwell method of coal getting was supposed to accomplish. And rather than make things better, it basically put a whole bunch of old coal miner skills out to pasture, replaced by a new method that was supposed to make things more efficient and ended up doing the opposite. Precisely this, acute psychological and social problems. The splintering of work tasks involve loss of public identity on the job. Again, that's another Tristan Bamforth finding. By the time that they divided the work to seven different tasks or seven different positions of which you did, the workers of different shifts did not see each other. You had the blaming, you had all of these things. That effect of splintering really did affect the public identity. And then just one more at the bottom of page 80, increased specialization of production leads inescapably to a greater need for predictability of work behavior and therefore for increased discipline in the workplace, which is to say now we're bringing the manager and the foreman in. Okay, what is their role with the workers? Comparing, say, the hewer, the mate, and the trammer from the old method of coal getting, where the hewer was the lead and it was a very friendly team. Now what you have are foremen under the longwall method whose job is to be the stick, to basically discipline the force, to try to keep them on task in an environment of which they don't feel any benefit of doing so and don't feel particularly motivated to pay attention to what the foreman says. So you know, there you go. This in just a little bit over a page, you've now recounted a whole bunch of findings from other studies.
And I think it's perfectly reasonable to believe that in the small world of academia back then that they were aware of these different sets of findings. I mean, certainly in that same section that you just quoted from, Merton relies on Roethlisberger, which we did in episode 33. So that work that came out, and he quotes Roethlisberger saying, "There exist no occupational names that have any social significance outside of the particular industry, factory, or even department in many cases." So the tying up of your identity to your job title and your rank is meaningless without context. But I think the other thing that's interesting in what you said about discipline and whose role it is to provide this leadership and this oversight. Literally less than a column later, he reminds us that it's not about power for power's sake. He says, "It may be found that the exercise of naked power no more produces a stable structure of social relations in industry than in other spheres of human behavior." So you cannot just imbue someone with power or otherwise allow them to run rampant and expect that this is going to stay this way. He's already mentioned labor relations and unions in there. He's already talked about empowering the worker and the worker rising up against this imposed structure. So, you know, it's reminding us that it's not power for power's sake.
I think also the interesting part that we've touched upon in multiple sort of instances of our conversation is really around this identity. So that the worker having a strong professional identity, but also having that element where, you know, the identity means something to the external world. So if I think about it, I mean, I remember the struggles while during the PhD to sort of explain to family, friends, what are you actually doing in the nitty-gritty, and then having to sort of overcome it by giving a more, just in a sense, simplified, but a kind of like a core concept just to explain what I was doing. And I'm fairly sure that there are more sophisticated professions that I would not be able to understand because I don't have the skills or the expertise. And therefore, like, simplifying it is something that many specialized professions have to go through. But on the topic of education, I find particularly interesting the comments around the advances in technology often are accompanied by the needs for higher education. I can't remember exactly where it is, meaning that there is an increasing distance between the people who have those higher levels of education and the people who are actually doing the job. And also at the same time, the workers are therefore unable to rise through the ranks because they cannot access the higher education. And I think that starts to build in more social elements of the future evolutions of the social communities within the workplace. So I found that element of future prospects quite interesting as well.
My natural gravitation would be towards the section on the engineer, but he also says the same about managers, that both of them, there's different ways in which the education plays a role in what they do. And it seems like, you know, with the engineer, it definitely promotes separation from both the manager and the worker. By pursuing greater abstraction, I'm sort of bringing in Abbott a little bit here. Greater abstraction, they use their education to design better machines, again, without cognizance of just what implications they really have on the work environment. It's sort of, you know, not in their area of interest. The use of not so much education, I suppose, but perhaps experience and expertise along with it. He also talks in page 81 about how the relationship between managers and workers sort of distance through the use of technology, in which their managers or the supervisors' knowledge becomes more abstract. And therefore, they take, there's sort of like a dimmer view of the one who's actually doing the work. Let me read the quote and we can debate if I've got my interpretation right. "Since technically trained personnel enter industry at a high level, they have little occasion to share the job experience of workers at an early stage of their careers and tend accordingly to have an abstract knowledge about rather than a concrete acquaintance with the perspective of workers." So there we're talking about managers who come in from an increasingly distant position from the workers, both in a social and an educational standpoint, who therefore come in looking down upon the workers, and it just sort of becomes a self-reinforcing cycle. It's not necessarily that they're better talented or that they're better knowledge. As a matter of fact, they probably aren't knowledgeable, because of the relationship being so distant from their own workers, it sort of reinforces the division.
So that's really interesting. I thought you were going to go to a completely different place with that. So I thought where you were going to go is to talk about the relationship between the engineer who develops the technology and the worker, manager, other interested party who deploys the technology. So here I thought you were going to pick up the part that says on page 82, the scientist has long disclaimed responsibility for attending to the ways in which this knowledge was applied. And this reminded me that we did for episode 92, we talked about the Manhattan Project and the atomic bomb and the distributed nature of developing that and allowed all the individuals advancing the science to claim a psychological distance to what it eventually might do when released out into the world. And certainly even the very few of the fathers of it then turned around and said, okay, I developed the science, but I don't actually want you to use it. Here's what we need to do to stop the Pandora's box contents from escaping. So I thought you were going to go down that route, because what Merton writes here is, it's the engineer's quote-unquote job, quotations in the original, note how effectively this defines the limits of one's role and thereby one's social responsibility to improve the processes of production. So back to the discussion we just had about labels and professions and whose role is which. This is almost saying that by fiercely delimiting and setting up boundaries of what is your job, it gives you the ability to distance yourself from social responsibility. So it's that label and that hierarchical position that are self-defining. So I thought that's where you were going. It's quite interesting.
I do admit I did see parallels with both. So I was just waiting to see which route would be taken. But absolutely, there are parallels with the engineer and the management or leadership. And I think that's important towards the worker. At the end of the day, the worker is always the one who's distant, right? Distanced from both categories, and the one who loses out on multiple elements. So the psychology, and also we've touched upon it with this idea of technology replacing technological unemployment. But there's also a mention of potential price wars. And it feels like what's being introduced in the picture is this idea of sort of a blackmail type threat to the worker, right? You can be replaced not only by another worker, but actually you can be replaced by technology.
Yeah, that's a great point. And one thing we should also mention is that the word docility as a characterization of the, not the ideal, what would be the vision of the preferred worker from the outside perspective or from the managerial perspective, docility seems to be the aim. And so it's not enough to ensure that they're silenced, but also that they are pliable. And that blackmail is basically there to try to keep them in their box, keep them in their lane, all the while the job becomes more specialized and in effect dehumanizing is sort of what where he's going with this. I mean, in the end, the purpose of the speech is to lay all of this social context out. It concludes with a whole bunch of a whole section on, all right, what do we do about this from a research perspective? What do we need to go out and start researching on? Not just what would be the research topics, but also how do you get sponsorships and how would the research team be organized, which kind of blends neatly into the second article, which we'll get to in a moment. But I wanted to check and see, is there anything else we wanted to cover on the first one? I mean, we can always come back to it, of course.
Yeah, so even commenting on research, he says straight up, there is a severely limited market for research in this field. So here's everything I said to you about how important it is, and somebody needs to do it, and here are the scary things that will happen if we don't understand it. However, if you're trying to build a research program on this, it says, it's supposed that fewer man hours of research activity are devoted to the intensive investigation of these problems central to our technological age than, say, to the design of alluring packages for perfumes. And I study the fragrance industry, so I love that part. And other such basic commodities, or to the planning of competitive advertisements for tobacco manufacturers, right? It's what I love, I thought, Tom, you'd get this one as well, is that he then goes on to say, we essentially need a Tennessee Valley Authority, a TVA, effort and patterns of collaborations between engineers and social scientists to get this research going. And no matter how good or seemingly self-evident the reason, it should be noted that this is the typical perspective of social research in industry. So that social research in industry, well, that's essentially what we are studying when we study the canon here. All the pieces we pick up are trying to look at that. And then he goes on to talk about methodology, and there's a section here talking about sociogramming, which is the precursor to what we did in episode 86 on the very early days of network research and how to map out a social network. So this is almost like for our junior scholar colleagues, this is the very long arm of a discussion and future research section. This is setting up your work. And it even says directions of research. And it says that this research is now a reaction against the earlier tendency to focus on the economic consequences of advances in technology. So that's exactly what Miranda brought up before, is that we're done looking at the economics now. We need to look at the people part.
I think what I appreciated the most of this was possibly three points. First, that it actually concludes with a bringing research, as in what should we do as researchers around this? And I think that was a very strong emphasis on research being practical and mindful of what's going on in the world. The second is the emphasis on the social setting. And that sort of, I mean, it's the foundation to that argument is very well laid out from the start. But the third is this recognition that research is not apolitical. It is, you know, there are interests in play. And the question is, are those interests the right interests that we should be serving? And I think that opens up an entire conversation around, you know, other ethical dimensions of research, but also professional values of the researcher.
And I think that brings us a perfect segue to the second article. Again, that is Selected Problems of Fieldwork in the Planned Community, published in 1947 in the American Sociological Review. And if I were to sum up the words that Merton has to potential researchers in doing their field work, it would be simply, be careful. Because the whole article, and it's not a very long article either, both of these articles are nice and short, and they're pretty approachable. They're not laden with all kinds of 1940s big words. They're very easy to read, but the whole article is all about different cautions about what could go wrong if you're about to go in as a research team and go studying, in this particular case, a planned community, which is to say a community that has been intentionally set up by some authority, such as, in this case, a housing area, where if you go in as a research team, chances are you're going to go in as in order to do some research on a topic of interest to management, for example. And here's all the things that could possibly go wrong based on your relationship that you establish with management. And I know it's interesting when you look at, say, taking potential scholar practitioners and saying that you're going to become, you know, we need to teach you how to be good, effective consultants with an organization in order to be able to provide them with useful recommendations on how they can do things better, and et cetera, et cetera. But there's a very clearly better and less better ways to go about it, because you are invariably entering into a social situation, which also has a political situation, and how you are perceived then can become somewhat deleterious to your research. The going in has been that you come in to do what the management bids you to do, go forth, do the research, come back with the recommendations, there you go. The social impacts of your being there are unimportant. Well, no. He's saying they definitely are, and he delineates a whole bunch of things where the research can go wrong precisely because people perceive the consultant or the researcher as an arm of the administration.
But he also talks potentially to the level of colleagues as researchers that both ways have their shortcomings. Both ways have their advantages, but both ways have their shortcomings. So in this situation, as will be appropriate to anybody doing field research, but particularly in this case, qualitative field research. So deep interviews with the stakeholders who are living in the communities. The options available to the research team were to be seen to meet with management and have the approval of management and therefore increase their legitimacy as researchers, increase the perceived importance of the project, and hopefully that the consequences or the outcomes of the research would be taken seriously to improve their conditions and to improve future planned housing. Or, on the other side, to identify with the individuals that they were studying, to build a rapport first, to almost snowball their legitimacy with recommendations from participants who had been interviewed in the first wave, and thereby necessarily distancing itself from management. And I think the important point zero there is that management and residents are two separate groups of individuals. Property managers and residents are two separate groups. This is not a community association or cooperative or, you know, a housing cooperative or family-led initiative. And it's safe to say that we would not be studying this phenomenon if there hadn't been tensions or something interesting to examine earlier. So they're not walking in and trying to upset a peaceful status quo. So those were the choices available to the research team. And they acknowledge a long tradition in sociology, like the Webbs, who were part of the founding team of the London School of Economics, as well as anthropologists, as well as the, in a way, techniques from journalism. And they do mention also the budding fields of polling. And so that's another thing they talk about is the public polling that has begun. So they borrow from all of those traditions to try and build an article about best practices for anyone else who would like to conduct this type of research. And then they fully assess themselves against the standards they set out. How well did we do on reducing aggression and increasing uptake? So in a way, this is our, as much as you can say, robustness checks in qualitative research.
Yeah, I will also mention that, they do make reference to the study, but they give a code name for the place where they did it, Crafttown, but they don't actually talk about the study itself. So this is all strictly about the challenges of doing the research. And I thought that that was fascinating, because if you're going to do somewhat of a retrospective, I almost always expect to see something a little bit more direct about what were they doing there? What was the research question or whatever? But I guess it by abstracting from it, it kind of makes it a little bit more useful, so that you don't think like, well, yeah, this happened in this one study. Maybe that was unique. But no, these are findings that really apply anywhere.
I think it's a great article that really sort of reminds me a lot of the core suggestions, core practices of interview data, accessing the field, particular qualitative, but there is survey type data. There is something there as well that's important to recognize. I think what I found particularly interesting was the
open recognition that as a researcher, you are not neutral. You will be associated with somebody, with their interests, and you need to deal with that type of perception. And how you deal with it is something that you really need to reflect about. I mean, obviously, there's more profound conversations to have along the lines of age, appearance, minorities, gender. But I think this is sort of the roots of those conversations. So I do remember when we did our doctoral training around collecting data through interviews, several speakers brought their experience. And somebody said, yes, well, you know, I am female and I do recognize myself to look younger than what I am. So, you know, this is something that I was immediately, oh, this is somebody that I really need to listen to. And they said, well, I actually tried to play this to my advantage. So recognizing that there is a perception which goes also beyond these associations, these political associations, I think it's important to build into the reflections of how do we collect data, how do we access the field, but also what does that data actually mean and how do we interpret it?
But then one of the core contributions of the article, in my opinion, was the question that they asked ostensibly after the end of the interview, and we can debate how we feel about this as researchers, where they said, the interview is over now, and I'd like your frank opinion. How did you really feel about being interviewed all this time? Which he called a, quote, chimney sweeping of aggression. So allowing people to feedback about the process of being interviewed and to discuss their feelings about being recognized in the research process and having their opinions taken into consideration. And the reason I wanted to discuss this as a point is that on the one hand, it is very similar to what our interview debriefs would now say. If you feel uncomfortable, you may raise this with a superior. If you'd like to remove your contributions from the project, you may do that in a certain way. So the idea that the interview doesn't stop when the last question is answered is something that we now have a mechanism for. But at the same time, according to Tom's point, okay, they didn't use the answers to that question in the original empirical article on Crafton that this is being discussed about, but they used it in this article. They used the responses to how did you feel about it in, again, the birth of metascience, this article, Research on Research. And I'm not sure how I feel about it. The first time I read it, I thought, well, it's just a teaching point. And people were super honest in their contributions, and many of them raised positivity around participating in research and a feeling of being listened to and a feeling of being included and having their voice recognized that the polling procedures of the time didn't come close to. So on the one hand, I think it's a positive movement for research. But on the other hand, I'm not sure whether the process of research did stop at the last question. And the fact that they explicitly worded that way with the benefit of hindsight makes me a bit uncomfortable. I'm not sure how you two thought about it or whether that even registered for you.
No, it did register with a little bit of skepticism, as in I'm totally on board with the debrief and sort of maybe even asking, especially your first interviewees, for a bit of feedback on the process. I think that's very valuable. But it is framed as an index of rapport. And I think here is where we start to mix and confuse approaches from the quants into the quals. And here is where I start to be a little bit itchy, let's say, because I think that if somebody hasn't got a rapport with you, those so-called, what is it, bottled up antagonism, it will not come out. If somebody doesn't want it to come out, it will not come out with the interviewer. It will come out at the family table at home or with their best friend or something like that. I think there's something here that perhaps might backfire, might not work. And I don't think it's... I think rapport is difficult to quantify, if not even impossible. I think you feel rapport. You have a feeling when you leave the interview setting, that person, you know, has been authentic, has opened up, has told me things, like I felt that that went well as an interview. I think it's very much a feeling that is based on experience and how you interact with human beings and your experience as an interviewer. And I think as much as it's good to do a debrief and so on, but it might not always emerge. That's my take.
My take is that, given that the whole idea of informed consent, as we understand it now, is so much more recent and was actually more an outgrowth of really, truly dangerous and unethical practices, not innocuous or well-intentioned like this so much. I guess, it's philosophically, how do you approach learning what you don't know about something? I am not bothered by this, given the context, would totally be opposed to it now because it violates so many principles that have been institutionalized. But I think it's worth asking ourselves now, and this would be probably a topic for another day, is has our current conception, the current approach to informed consent become stifling? And so how do we know whether or not we need to revisit it? And is there a way to, study around the boundaries without violating principles and all that sort of thing? Our methods have got to constantly evolve with new situations. Because, one of the reasons why they wanted to ask that question in the first place is a theme throughout the whole article about how do people respond to being either inside or outside of a research project that's going in their midst. To see the research team as an instrument of management, if I'm just a tenant, is this research going to be in some way threatening to me? Or if it's the other way around, where the research team gets a little bit too intimate with the tenants, then does it become a threat to management? Does it become a venue by which the tenants start to assert authorities that they didn't have before? There's all sorts of implications for how the research team goes about doing things. And it's always evolving because nowadays, of course, we see a lot of rebellion against the old ways of doing business or how things were before. There's challenges against against some of our institutionalized practices in the workplace. How do you go ahead and study it without finding yourself on, being perceived as in one camp or the other, the management or the workforce, and actually do quality research that gets at adding to our knowledge in an objective, rational, empirical, or justifiable fashion is always going to be a delicate balance. And this article lays out a whole slew of pitfalls that we have to be mindful of, especially in fieldwork.
I think it's important where they say, although interviews are standardized in the sense of involving a definite schedule, this is page 310, the interview situation was experienced in strikingly different ways by informants. And they set out six different ways that the interviews are experienced. So one, a democratic channel for the expression of opinion. Two, an intellectually demanding experience. Three, a moral inventory. Four, an institutionalized pattern of social surveys. Five, an ego building and status conferral function. And six is a catharsis. So just at a top level with those six things, half of them are direct pillars of the Merton canon of research. So talking about moral inventory, talking about institutionalization, talking about what confers status and how our status judgment made. Only Merton could have written this, and only the students that follow from that would have taken up that mantle in their research. But the other three, I think, do still exist in our approach to research, which is recognizing the time and the value and the contribution that participants provide to research, allowing them the time and the space to use their voice and to share their lived experience in whatever direction it might go. Research being messy, research being noisy, and that neither qualitative nor quantitative approaches have a monopoly on this, right? And I think that's what Miranda was telling us about before, this what he calls the systematic canvas of differentials in the sources of field data. So I think that's what Miranda was getting at. Or at least that's, to me, the connection there.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated, as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.